Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 2nd of March. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Stepan Guy.
Wow, March already, Eddie. How are you feeling, Kev? You were fighting fit last week. You had a bit of a blip.
Yeah, I'm not fighting fit, but I'm getting better. Yeah, so we should say at this point, Ramadan Kareem for all those Muslims out there who are now fasting greatly for the next 28 days or lunar cycle. It's all just started here in Egypt. So yeah, good luck.
And Sapan, you were out in the Middle East, I believe, recently. What do you make of it out there? What's your sum up like Abu Dhabi and Dubai in a couple of words?
Yeah, so I was in Abu Dhabi for half term. Had a few meetings while I was there as well for my sins. Abu Dhabi is very different to Dubai, but I think the whole of that region, the one thing you can walk away with is there is massive appetite for what the future holds, right? So whether that's everything from, you know, what we talk about with strategic metals all the way through to crypto, AI, robotics, the whole thing is just, you know, on everyone's lips. That's all they're talking about. There's almost like a FOMO of, you know, missing out on this big revolution that's about to happen in the world. And it really, you know, you spend a couple of days on the ground there and it really pumps you up rather than having to face the doldrums of grey clouds over in the UK these days.
I always get that buzz from going there into the Middle East, the countries like that, sort of even Kuwait and places, just the positivity of the people around you. Everybody's so pumped up, as you say, and just super positive, which rubs off on you. And then you come back to grey England and it's like everyone's just like looks down, doesn't say hello. There's no kind of community feel, whereas out there you do. It does make you feel more confident, doesn't it? You come back feeling more confident about life.
It's not just the Middle East, you know, it's the rest of the world. Everyone's feeling it right now. Whenever I go down to Malawi, I mean, I travel with Ethiopian Airlines and, you know, they built a massive hub in Addis Ababa.
Yeah.
You go to Addis and, you know, you end up spending a couple of hours walking around in the airport, and it is just jam-packed with people traveling. And, they're not going on holidays. They're all going on business. They're all suited and booted, carrying briefcases. Yeah. Stuff's happening. Stuff's happening around the world.
Yeah, I remember Kev, he said that he flew into there, I think, on one of his recent trips down, I believe, to Zambia. He went via Ethiopia, and he said it was just mad. It was almost like Ethiopian Airlines hub. Like he said, I don't think he even saw any other aircraft there other than Ethiopian Airlines. So not surprising. But let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. I mean, they're literally, I don't think there are any other, you know, there's no week that goes by without Donald Trump dominating. But what I will say is, who has been to Washington this week? Or it might actually be easier to ask who hasn't been to Washington this week to visit Trump. Obviously, we saw Keir Starmer visit Washington, meeting with Trump at the White House on Thursday. And the meeting kicked off around 5:15 GMT with Trump welcoming Starmer, calling him a special man and saying it's a great honour to host him. He sketched out the day, obviously chats, lunch, work on some deals, then obviously a press Q&A later. And I don't know if you saw it, but Trump name-checked trade, Russia and a potential UK state visit. Obviously, you know, there was a letter there from the King, which was invited him on this unprecedented second state visit to the UK, and obviously he's very excited about it, and he's pretty much confirmed that he's gonna visit. Don't know when that'll happen, but what did you make of the body language of Starmer? I mean, it looked like a little kid, didn't he? Lost with against Big Trump. Like, what did you make of that visit?
Yeah, look, what I want to know is how many times Keir Starmer must have rehearsed what he was going to say to Trump and pulling out that invitation from the King, right? I mean, that was a awesome little bit of PR right there. But I think Starmer's done a pretty good job over there.
And I think that's going to pain a lot of people to say that, actually, isn't it? I mean, the front page of the paper today says Charmer Starmer pulls off diplomatic win in White House. So the press are actually now, is he going to redeem himself from all the crap of the budget and all the you know, the policies he's put through?
Look, time will tell. But when you're looking at things from Trump's perspective, and we're all talking about the words that came out of his mouth, but the one thing, you know, we've heard time and again, and I'm sure you've heard this, is judge Trump on what he does, not on what he says. So, let's see where he gets to with all these geopolitical concerns that he's decided to put at the forefront of his administration's kind of to-do list.
What has he actually done, though? What has Trump done? It's almost like, that person who was wobbling the plates to keep them all up on sticks. And Trump's come along and basically just chopped all the sticks down, let all the plates crash to the floor, and then let's see what plates didn't break. That's my analogy on the situation. He's like, I'm gonna break it. If it doesn't break, then okay, it might be okay. If it does break, good. Then we can move on and start something new.
Yeah, I feel like he's shaken things up, right? He was talking about peace between Russia and Ukraine before him, right? No one was talking about it. It was all about how much ammo, how many dollars we're sending to Ukraine to fight the war, rather than talking about, well, let's just stop it. And okay, he approaches it from his own kind of perspective, a very kind of commercial New Yorky businessman perspective, but at least it's top of the agenda now, isn't it?
He shoots from the hip, but as you're saying, he's also put so many executive orders through. I mean, even just closing down US aid within its, for, with Doge and everything. I mean, that is a massive step forward. Well, whether you could argue it's a step forward or step backward is, it remains to be seen. Certainly for countries who are receiving on the receiving end of the aid, it's been a massive blow. But how much money are they actually saving by going through some of these departments, which were just not even needed when you look at them, So there is probably some sort of process going on there, but let's just have a look and break it down. I mean, the first thing is the trade deal. Do you think that it's possible that with these, whatever he's done, shoring up this friendship with the between UK and US, and obviously the King may have had a nice little say in that with his invite, and we know how much Trump loves a gift. Do you think that there is going to be some sort of not only a non-tariff in place, but do you think there could be a trade deal between the UK and the US?
Look, from my perspective, I think the key thing is what are we going to give to the US, right? That is the question on most people's lips. Trump's gonna say what people in the room want to hear, and whether it's Starmer or a few weeks ago when Narendra Modi, the PM of India, was on stage with him in the same press conference room, and they asked, well, did you have a good quality chat about tariffs, because apparently India has the highest tariffs on US goods. And he said, look, there's a way that we're going to work this out. And they walked away from that with that whole sense. But from my perspective, like I keep saying, time will tell whether this chat about some kind of a bilateral trade agreement actually comes into fruition. And what does it actually mean? Because, we throw, especially politicians, they throw around these terms. But what does it mean for the layperson, right? Is everyone going to start building stuff for America here? At the current energy prices, I doubt we can build anything.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the critical minerals deal? I mean, this is a massive thing now. I mean, obviously, Trump is pushing a Ukraine minerals deal, critical minerals, whether, and we can talk a bit about, whether actually Ukraine actually has any rare earths and magnetic minerals in a minute. But he's using it almost as a kind of Russia deterrent, claiming that Putin will not play around with US workers involved and that the deal is going to hold. Do you think that is actually possible? Do you think there's going to be some sort of backstop put in place here? I mean, I know that obviously Zelensky is there as we're recording this on Friday, and it would be interesting to see if we get any developments in terms of. But it's funny because he started off, US started negotiating with Russia without Ukraine. Now Ukraine and the US are negotiating without Russia. It's a comedy, isn't it?
Well, in his press conference with Starmer, Trump had forgotten that he'd called Zelensky a dictator as well,
Yeah, then it
right?
move on. Next question.
Exactly. What I want to figure out is, even if you look at the US's own geological survey, how much critical minerals is actually hosted in Ukraine, right? Or rare earth, as DJT is calling it.
Maybe that's the same deal he's going to strike with the UK. We're going to give all our rare earths to the US.
Just pretend we've got a hell of a lot, the load of the tin mines down in Cornwall have got rare earths in it. I mean, when you look at the number, I mean, I don't know if you saw the piece, but Ed Conway, the Sky journalist, he did a fantastic post on X with talking about whether or not there are actually any rare earths in him. This guy is the guy that wrote Material World. He does know his minerals, and he found one or two mines. And do you know where they were, in which part of Ukraine they were?
Donbass.
In the Crimea. So they were right in the
Yeah.
part that Russia owned. And I'm just thinking, this is a comedy. This is only going to end in failure. But what they are very prevalent in Ukraine, as you know, is lithium mines. They've got a vast amount of lithium. But I don't know whether he's just getting confused with his different, elements. And I don't know. It is a bizarre one. But I think more to the point, do you think?
I was just going to say, even on lithium, I mean, the US has way more lithium than you can find in Ukraine. It's a lot better to drill, baby, drill over in the US right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think of any kind of potential? Does this open, Starmer's already said potentially he's happy to put some troops on the ground in the form of NATO. I just wonder whether or not are we creating a scenario whereby they're going to have, NATO troops there protecting any, whether that be US interests or workers, and then it becomes a kind of Article 5 comes into question. As soon as there's an attack against one of those workers, everybody's drawn in, and you're creating more of a bad situation there.
Well, I mean, Trump reckons that having US operators in Ukraine is part of the peace package, right? So it's a deterrent, as you said. Whether that's reality or not, I'll tell you, there's probably only one guy who knows, and he's sat in Moscow right now.
Absolutely.
Exactly. It's almost like a West Germany, East Germany situation all over again. I mean, do we want that only a bit further east? No, I don't think so. So the cost of that, even from a UK perspective, would be absolutely unbelievable. The one thing that was announced, I think, this week was that he's basically said he's going to cut 0.2% per annum off our GDP given to the people who need it the most, as in the aid, our overseas aid, and he's going to put it into guns and bombs and defense. So what do you think about that one?
It's playing the same kind of rule book as Musk and Trump have done with USAID, right? Cut the easiest stuff first, because you don't want to cut anything that hurts the layperson who's going to vote for you in the next round. Imagine if they said, no, we're going to take that 2.5% away from education or health or anything like that. It just wouldn't fly. So unfortunately, foreign aid is always going to be the first victim in these things.
But this was the joke about USA or US aid. It was named US aid, but it's actually USAID because it was never an aid organization from the very beginning. It was never just purely aimed at aid. It was aimed at let's go in there and see if we can help these guys and make a profit. It was never US aid as such. But I mean, the scenario with it seems to be now that it seems to have been infiltrated by every three-letter organization in the USA to actually, increase their influence across the world, which is just bizarre.
It is a bizarre one, but did you also? So, I mean, talk about bizarre. So I think your blood was boiling on this one, Kev. I think you sent me a message. Was the AI generated video that Trump's Truth Social posted on February 25th, with a luxury Trump Gaza resort featuring obviously skyscrapers, yachts, giant Trump statue, and then obviously
A
they've already,
gold
yeah. And there was a kid with a Trump balloon. There was little miniature tourist like attract, little sort of like mementos with Trump in there that you could buy. Trump was sat on a lounger drinking cocktails with Netanyahu to his side in front of Trump Gaza. And then the song in the background was the lyrics were Donald's coming to set you free, bringing the light for all to see. No more tunnels, no more fear. Trump Gaza is finally here. I mean, this is just madness, isn't it? And I think, as you say, can you imagine how infuriating that is for people, for the Gazans to see?
So look, on that, yes, on the face of it, it is. But one thing I heard and the other day was actually there's a lot of hidden messages in that AI generated video. Things like the Trump Gaza front is taken from Trump's view of what his Trump Taj Hotel was going to look like, and that was a complete disaster, and he lost billions in it. There's a lot of even the bearded belly dancers. There's a lot of hidden messages in
I like the bit where Musk's eating like flatbreads and hummus and stuff and dripping it down. And you're thinking, what is this? He's showering dollars in the air. And then Trump's got like in a lap dancing club or something with one. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? This is just,
that. It's just hilarious that he actually
it's like a
posted it.
nightmare. It's a nightmare vision, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, but the hilarious thing is we could see it and somebody would have satirized that. But for him, the President of the United States of America, to post it This is just like beyond the pale. And I'm sure many people in the Middle East are just shaking their heads going, at the minute, Donald, we are listening to you and we are putting up with you, but this will only last so long.
Absolutely. Okay, Sapan, while you're here, should we talk sovereign?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, great news. There's two RNSs in the week, or since you've last been on, obviously confirming that graphite from the Kseer Rutile graphite project meets the key specifications for both refractory and expandable expanded graphite applications. If we look at them, break them down, obviously, the refractory market, the Kseer graphite meets all the required characteristics for refractory use, a sector that accounts for 24% of global natural graphite demand. Coarser flake graphite, which is preferred in this market, attracted prices up to $1,193 per tonne in Q4 2024, significantly higher than battery grade graphite at $564 per tonne. The incremental production cost for Kseer graphite is $241 per tonne. So just talk us through that. I mean, because obviously we saw that announcement of the refractory market. What does it mean? I mean, does it obviously opens up to a, I guess, a whole new market with 24% of the global natural graphite in demand for that. Just talk us through the rationale why you want to move out into potentially different markets.
When you're graphite, you're not producing a completely homogeneous product that can only have one particular type of use if that graphite indeed ticks a whole bunch of boxes. So imagine graphite as a bowl of cornflakes, right? When you produce the concentrate, it's a bowl of cornflakes. Every flake is different in size, in its shape, and it's even in its hardness. The smaller flakes, the tiny flakes, anything that's considered what is small, very small, or fine, that all ends up mainly in the battery space, which is about 60% of graphite use now. It sells for about $550 to $600 a ton today. Everyone who believes in an energy transition is telling you it could be worth $1,500, $2,000 a ton in the future. But that's essentially the small stuff. In that same bowl, you'll have big flakes. And those big flakes, you can either crush them down and use them as small flakes, or you could put them into a market, as long as they have certain characteristics, you put them into a market which has been around for yonks, which is the refractories market, right? So that's making bricks that line crucibles, line furnaces, smelters, making sure that the outside of the smelter doesn't melt while you're melting the stuff inside. And that graphite use, those larger flakes get something like around $1,200 a ton rather than the smaller ones, because there's less of them. But more importantly, they have certain characteristics which our RNSs over the last few weeks have shown that graphite has exactly those characteristics. So they don't disintegrate, they don't essentially swell up and then contract back down. They can withstand high temperatures, pressures, all that, all the atmosphere that you could expect inside one of these massive furnaces that's producing steel. And as long as your graphite can do that, it can be sold into that market at almost double the price of what it can be sold into the battery space. So for us now to sit back and say, actually, we have now confirmed that our graphite has all the characteristics to be sold into 94% of all end uses of graphite. That's a big deal for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And then obviously we saw the announcement that related to the expandable or expanded graphite market, with test work confirming that those medium to coarse Kseer graphite suitable for use in flame retardants, gaskets, seals, and brake linings, and then demand in that sector is nearing, it's like 100,000 tons annually, growing at sort of 6% compound annual growth rate, with prices reaching $1,140 per ton in December 2024. And obviously testing by ProGraphite demonstrated high expansion volumes, which will position you well. So just talk us through that and another market there. So effectively you're now the Kseer graphite has now been confirmed as suitable for the three largest natural graphite market: battery anodes, refractories, and expandable expanded applications. I mean, this is big news.
Yeah, so when you buy a piece of furniture and you have that green sticker on it that says, flame retardant or non-combustible and all that kind of good stuff, these days it's usually because it's got this expandable graphite in there, right? So you try and set fire to your new sofa, and you'll see it basically starts to turn black. It puts out any kind of smoke. It puts out the fire. It stops the oxygen. It stops the layer between the sofa and the flame from continuing to ignite. And that market in itself, as you said, is a 100,000 ton market. Again, it uses the big flake stuff, so it sells for a larger cost per ton than into the batteries market. And what we've shown with that RNS is basically the test work done in Germany says that our graphite can be used in that context as well.
Yeah. So given this broad market applicability now and your industry low production costs of around $241 per ton, how does Sovereign now plan to position itself against established producers out there, particularly in China as well, where we've seen very low cost and secure long-term offtake agreements in place?
So you're going to hear a bit more about this over the coming weeks from us, and particularly because one of the things that the graphite markets never really either decided to share with investors or tell investors or investors, maybe people just haven't done the work, is just how much does it cost a Chinese graphite producer to produce this graphite? We've done that work. We figured it out. And what we figured out was, without giving the punchline away, that it costs the Chinese about $260 a ton to produce graphite. When you
That
look
was the
at,
punchline, Sapan. You just gave it away.
yeah, well,
Yeah.
I was never good at jokes. So at $260 a ton, and the rest of the market anywhere between $500 to $1,500 a ton in terms of their costs of production, and us coming along and saying, actually, we can produce it at $240 a ton. We're the only guys who can compete with China in the graphite industry today. Full stop.
So, do you think a lot of the other graphite producers are planning their way forward on the premise that the graphite price is going to escalate?
Well, what you've seen is a lot of the graphite companies have started or initiated or have already, in the last 4 years, gone downstream, trying to capture margin there. The margin between your anode material graphite and what a battery maker is ready to pay for it. We have no interest in that, right? Well, I've said it before on to you guys. We're not a chemistry set. We're not a chemicals company. We're a mining company, and that's what we're going to, stick to. I wouldn't consider anyone on our team, bar maybe our chief technology officer on the graphite side, Surinder Garg, having anywhere near the competency, the understanding of trying to turn graphite into a freely saleable, tradable anode material, and what that plant should look like. That's not our gig. We are simply going to produce the most graphite, the lowest cost graphite into the world. And we're happy to keep that position.
And you're going to have a lot of it as well, no?
Yeah, and look at all these guys who are going downstream and building battery anode plants. Yeah, best of luck to them, because we'll be sat there ready to sell them our high quality, low cost graphite when they're ready for it.
So tell me, how does suddenly having a potential sale price for the graphite of, let's even say, $1,000 a ton, even though it's obviously higher than that, how does that affect the net present value of the figures that you put through? Because I'm assuming you used about $5,600.
Oh, look, we used a basket price, and that basket price told us that we would essentially, on 2024's prices, our basket of or our bowl of flakes, going back to that analogy, would get around $1,600 a ton. And what we used in our actual models when we did the optimized PFS was $1,290 a ton. So we built in some extra fat in there.
Okay, so some of this stuff, some of the graphite can be sold for a couple of $1,000 a ton.
Oh yeah, look, back in 2024, if you some of our consultants have told us that the real big stuff, the jumbo stuff, was being sold close to $1,800 a ton.
Okay, so where are you? If I put you in the position that you had. Because we were talking earlier just about the share price appreciation over the last year. You're up 99.5% or something like that from a year ago. I think you were around the 22, 23p, and now we're sitting at 45p. Where do you think this project would be in today's market if it wasn't not very interesting, titanium and graphite?
Good question.
Because my view is at this moment in time, if you were sitting on this and it was of the same proportions, gold and silver and copper, do you think it would be worth significantly more as a project or not?
Well, I'll give you some, rather than telling you what I think this is worth, I'll give you some kind of data points
Some
as to what,
comparisons.
well, let's put it this way. With my old kind of institutional investment banking hat on and thinking about, the big institutional fund managers that I talked to and the M&A deals that I'd struck in the past, the primary multiple or the primary way to kind of look at the value of mining companies was always what's known as the PNAV multiple. Basically, what is the underlying value of the project? So your NAV or your NAV, your net asset value, which is essentially your net present value from any study, plus or minus any cash and debt you may have, and how that relates to your current share price. And what you'd see over time, and this has been proven time and again over the last 20, 25 years in the mining industry, is you always start off at something like 0.1 times your NPV. And by the time you are in production on day dot, you're usually one times your NPV. Now, if you're in a high growth market like gold or certain royalties, or even today, copper, you could go 1.2 times your NPV. So what people are saying there is you're worth what your project is worth, but you're also worth a bit more because we believe that you have more growth to come. And what you'd see is that going from 0.1 to 1 or 1.2 would be a gradual increase over time, depending on where you were in the genesis of your project. So when you did a resource estimate, you'd probably end up about 0.2 times your underlying value. By the time you've done a scoping study, you're about 0.3, 0.4 times. By the time you've done a PFS, you're about 0.5, 0.6 times. By the time you've done your DFS, you're probably 0.7 to 0.8 times that value because most things have been de-risked. So the market is saying that actually your share price should be reflecting at least 80% of your underlying value at that point in time. Now that's what we see continuously happens in the mining space, and that's what a lot of deals in the past have been struck on the basis that if I was to acquire this project, it's trading at below what it should be based on its underlying inherent value, and I can pay X times more in order to make it mine, at which point it would be worth whatever I'm worth today.
Okay, good explanation. So, what was your net present value?
So our pre-tax net present value on our optimized PFS was 2.3 billion.
Okay, and that's the figure that they use, the pre-tax one or the post-tax one?
You'd want to build in a post-tax, but the reason why we gave a pre-tax and not a post-tax value in the pre-feasibility study is simply because those discussions have just not been had with the Malawian government around what the fiscal terms of Kasia would look like. So, we didn't want to second guess those.
But you're probably talking about 1.6 million, or sorry, 1.6 billion as opposed to something in that region.
Exactly.
So if you were saying that pre-feasibility study is done, and that would get you at 0.4 or 0.5 of the net present value, then you'd be looking at somewhere in the region of 800 million market cap, and your current market cap is £345 million. So that gives people an idea of, you haven't been valued as highly because you have rutile, titanium oxide, and graphite instead of something a bit more fanciful, if you like gold, silver, copper. But the interesting thing is that I think what most people haven't really clicked on is that the reason why this is not seen as very fanciful and wonderful is because we haven't found any of the bloody stuff for 80 years. So it's unusual. And that can go one of two ways. It can either be ignored or it can be valued even more highly because they're harder to find. Now, that was a statement, by the way. I'm not asking you to answer the question because there isn't one. But Say what you want.
I think the point here is, go back to our optimized PFS announcement, look at those numbers, and figure out whether this thing is worth what it currently is in the market. We talk millions and billions, and it's easy to get lost in those numbers. But if you just hone down into those numbers, I was trying to explain it to a lay investor the other day, and we're talking about a project where for $665 million, you're going to print about $400 million of EBITDA for at least the next 25 years, if not 50, 60, 70 years. Now, if I was to turn those numbers into something that's a bit more palatable for our day-to-day, if I was to say, hey, Kev, Phil, you can buy this flat in London, right, for 600,000 pounds, and you're guaranteed rent of £400,000 for the next 25 years. Who would not think that's a pretty decent gig?
Yeah, if I had 600,000, I'd buy one. But yeah, no, it's a very good analogy because there's £400,000 of free cash flow, I presume. It's not, that's after all costs. So yeah, it is a project that is sitting there. And I suppose the question I would ask you, just for everybody else's sake more than anything, what could you see that will not make this project come to life, as in will not happen?
You're basically asking me about the risks, right? So, operation. Look, let's start. Let's go through the risks. Geologically, it's been looked at time and again. That's all fine. Operationally, we dug a massive test pit. We showed that this thing can be mined, processed, turned into a high quality product. The marketability of the product, a marketability risk. Well, the first thing we did when we found the rutile was anyone in the titanium industry, take away our fresh ore or take away some of our rutile product. Tell me if you like it or not. And everybody loved it. So we know that the rutile is completely saleable. Off the back of the RNSs this month and towards the back end of last year, we've now shown that our graphite can be sold into 94% of the graphite market. So we're good on that front as well in terms of marketability. Financing the thing, building it. Look, that's not that. As far as we're concerned, that's not a big risk. The team has done this time and again. We've built these things out time and again. At times, we've sold them to majors, so we're pretty happy with that potential. Logistically, I mean, you couldn't be closer to the rail than the railway going over your resource, right? So that's not an issue. The only concerns are those concerns that we have zero control over as a management team, right? Geopolitical risk, the macro world, and where it's headed. But apart from that, there's very few risks in this story.
Okay, so Sapan, moving on, how are you feeling as a Manchester United supporter this season?
Don't answer
Well,
that question, Sapan.
we just came off the back of beating the mighty Ipswich with a man down.
I mean, I watched that. It was like 0-0, 0-1, 1-1, 1-0, 2-1, 2-2, and I was like, "Oh, are we actually going to be able to hold on to this?" Like, it's laughable at the moment, isn't it?
Ten minutes, and it must feel really good watching Liverpool when you're going through these times.
Well, every dog has a day, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've I think everyone from Ratcliffe down to Amorim down to us as fans have pretty much written off at least the Premier League this season. So we're not concerned with whoever wins that. That's not important now.
Says Manchester United supporter, never.
It's been annoying watching like the likes of Arsenal just drop points. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just frustrating that
Come on,
frustration
guys, give
for.
us some credit. We've only lost one game all season.
Yeah,
It's
no.
brutal, and we've been imperious in beating people, beating Man City into a whimper, Newcastle into a whimper,
Yeah,
and
I mean, you did really well at Plymouth as well. That was outstanding as well, wasn't it?
yeah, well, do you know what? It's an absolute blessing in disguise now because the Champions League now, we've got a free weekend. They've got a week's rest now before we play Paris Saint-Germain. It's beautiful.
Rest
So
all your rest, rest
almost
all.
like it was planned.
Yeah, Arne Slot's got the easiest job in the world, hasn't
At the minute, yeah. And Amarin's got one hell of a job,
he?
hasn't he? Honest. So what are we thinking about the new Formula One season? Okay, there's been some testing going on this week, and the good old British
Well, I think
driver there,
Hamilton, everybody's
Hamilton
waiting
in
with
his
bated
Ferrari.
breath. Yeah, absolutely. It's
He was faster than his teammate, wasn't he? It's faster than Leclerc. Is it Leclerc he's with?
Clerk.
Leclerc. So we'll see what happens with that. What are your plans then, Sapan? Sports wise, coming into this sporting period of time.
Well, I think over the next couple of days, it's all about and at the risk of failing the Norman Tebbit test, it's all about India winning the ICC Champions Trophy, hopefully. Play New Zealand in Dubai on Sunday. Had a nice little run,
Did
having
you catch any
beaten.
cricket while you were there?
No, unfortunately, no. I ended up being quite busy in Abu Dhabi. Didn't make it over to Dubai.
So, what's the format? Is it a one game?
Yeah, it's 1 day standard format. India just got last weekend, just got okay, just well, I wouldn't even call it a contest, but they beat Pakistan. So that was that's always
Oh
good
dear, we
to
have some rivalries going here, India, Pakistan,
Yeah.
Liverpool, Manchester
Yeah.
United.
But I think New Zealand on
No.
Sunday will be a proper test.
Yeah, well, Australia
Okay.
seem to have fallen away, haven't they?
Good.
South Africa are normally the other big challenge, but yeah, very interesting.
Cool. Well, I just want to extend our thanks and say Sapangai, CCO of Sovereign Metals, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
Thank you, Sapan. Hopefully, we'll speak to you in the not too distant future. And yeah, we look forward. I mean, it would be very interesting to talk about some of the other companies that you guys are involved in as a team. I've had some discussions with you off camera before on those, so maybe that's our next podcast to talk to them about some of the other stuff that you're involved in, which is at an earlier stage as well.
Sure, would love to do that.
Yeah, well, it's always good to have Sap on it and get his view on things and things. But obviously, one thing I will say is, there was late news breaking story on Friday evening, and this sort of, I wouldn't say caught us unaware, because we were aware, we did discuss at the top of the show that Zelensky would be visiting the Oval Office on Friday. But obviously, the significant news we saw was a shouting match in the Oval Office with Trump and JD Vance trying to humiliate Zelensky, what was effectively live on TV in front of pretty much the whole of the world media, certainly in front of the US media and a lot of the British media, which was then beamed around the world. The meeting descended into chaos as Trump and Vice President turned on the Ukraine leader. US President publicly threatened Zelensky, telling him to agree a rapid ceasefire and give territory to Putin, make a deal or we're out, were his words. He also accused Zelensky of gambling with World War III and mocks his dress sense. And he then said, "No, you've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble. This will make great television." I mean, tell me it was orchestrated without telling me it was orchestrated, that Kev, because it certainly felt
Well,
like it.
maybe pantomime season carried on until the 28th of February, I mean, they do say pantomime carries on. I mean, I was flabbergasted. I couldn't believe how they basically ambushed and treated Zelensky. I mean, I'm no Zelensky supporter, and I'm no Putin supporter, to be honest, either of them. But I felt like it was the children of what are running the madhouse. It was like unbelievable. There was no decorum whatsoever, was there? It was just unbelievable. It was like, and to then for Vance to then throw in, "You were on the stage with our opponents,"
Yes. Yeah, with Biden.
that was almost, you were with the enemy and now you want us to support you, sort of thing. And
Nothing to do with the fact that they were an elected, he was the elected president at the time.
absolutely. I mean, maybe it wasn't wise if he was on the road campaigning and stuff like that
Yes.
from Zelensky's point of view. But at the end of the day, Zelensky also was receiving literally hundreds of billions of dollars from the US, and that was the president at the time. So what can you say? I think Europe and probably any common sense voices I've heard since on, whatever social media have been just like, none of them have been good for America anyway, in terms of what was said and what was done. I mean, it looks like Trump has gone, met Putin, and basically said, "Right, China, Russia, ourselves. We'll be the superpowers. We'll be the ones in charge, and I'll make this happen, right? And this America first thing, I thought was partially a good thing, but it seems like it's very dangerous now. It's very dangerous the way he's going about it, because he's not, it's not an if or a but or a maybe. It's I'm going to threaten you, or this is going to happen. You know, whether that be the Middle East, whether that be Ukraine, whether it be Canada, whether it be Mexico. I mean, we did talk at the top of the show about, you know, he's thrown all the plates in the air and he sees which ones crash and break. Well, it looks like they're all breaking.
I mean,
And
Moscow's going to be the one celebrating this for sure. They'll be the ones who, I mean, they've even come out and started saying they love seeing him being slapped down, basically, was the comments from the Kremlin.
yeah,
I mean,
no, Putin's going to be smiling from ear to ear, isn't he? Because he's.
I think it summed up that someone said the world changed in 90 minutes. And I must admit, driving home from and listening to it on the news bulletin, I did have that feeling of what has happened? Like, you know, we've all alluded to, haven't the past, that it feels like we're not in a cold war, we're in a freezing war. You know, this is worse than the Cold War at times. And I genuinely do feel like I had a feeling, like even the kid, the daughter was saying to me, "Is this World War Three?" Because it's the headline on the British news was World War Three, because he'd mentioned that. And I'm thinking, like, what is he? He's cozying up now. I think you summed it up earlier. You said he'd rather be friends with Russia than the West and the Ukraine. And I think that's the reality now, isn't it? This is a new friendship.
It's a new friendship because what I see Trump wants to do is, if he can reduce his net spend on defense, then that will free up literally hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars over the next 10 years to correct their economy. And that's what he wants.
Yeah,
He's a
absolutely.
deal maker, isn't he? He's a
Yeah, no,
deal
he
maker.
is. He's absolutely
Everything's a deal.
ruthless. He's ruthless. If someone steps on his toes, what I would say is I did respect Zelensky for when Trump was started the sort of raising his voice and talking over him. I did like the fact that Zelensky didn't just cow down to him. He actually started going back at him and saying, "Let me tell you this." And I thought fair play to him, because if the whole of that Oval Office, including most of the US press, was against you, and let's not forget, this negativity started when one of the journalists or the backroom staff came out and said to Zelensky, "Have you even got a suit? Look at the way you rock up. It's disrespectful." I mean, how can you start to talking to a leader of a sovereign country from the backroom office and start telling him what he should and shouldn't be wearing? You know, this is a guy who puts himself on the front line. He's been targeted by Russian missiles in Kiev. He is on the front line a lot of the time. You know, he wants to be with the people and dress as a soldier. You know, he's always hanging out with soldiers.
Yeah.
It's
Anyway, we're not going to solve the thing, but it was
no.
good to talk about it. But it makes me want to go and buy more gold and silver.
Yeah, I know. Charles was saying in the group, wasn't he? Gold 4,000 after this. And I said, well, let's see how the markets. I mean, funnily enough, the markets were open on the Friday during the time when this happened. And I think the
Yeah.
markets, there was a slight dip, but they did bounce back from my understanding of the way they finished on Friday. So, but anyway, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best week mover to date is Great Southern Copper, GSCU is the ticker. They're up some 60% after reporting exceptional assay results from the phase one drilling at the Mostaza mine in Chile. Drill hole CNG25DD001 returned 20 meters at 3.31% copper and 270 grams per ton of silver from 27 meters depth, including 7 meters at 5.72% copper and 490 grams per ton of silver, significantly exceeding the historical assays. The mineralization confirmed as structurally controlled and open in all directions, suggests potential for a high-grade copper silver deposit. Planning for phase two drilling, resource expansion, and metallurgical studies is underway. And CEO Sam Garrett highlighted the results' significance, emphasizing their potential to enhance project economics. What do you make of those grades, Kev? I mean, we're looking at sort of 3% for 20 meters of copper, 270 grams per ton of silver, 27 depth, 7 meters at 5.7% copper, and 490 grams per ton of silver. I think we need to get Sam on. I mean, this is one that we've looked at in the past, but it just feels like this one is under the radar.
Yeah, it's actually very good grades, especially in that part of the world, because in Chile, anything 0.5% or less seems to be pretty damn good, but those 3% is going to be amazing. And I mean, I think also the silver looks very prospective as well. And yeah, I'm expecting some sort of silver run over the next while, so that could become very, very interesting. Any of the companies that have silver ongoing, I think, is going to be a real added value for these companies.
Yeah, I mean they've got so that Mastaza mine is the copper silver, but they've also got two early stage copper gold projects, which are I think the San Lorenzo and the Especularita projects, which again are located in that sort of like belt in Chile. And then they've also got, I believe, a lithium mine or project that the Monte, which is located in that Pre-Andean region as well, in sort of Salar de Atacama, which apparently is Chile's premier lithium producing region with a lot of well-established lithium mining operations and infrastructure. So, all right, lithium's gone off the boil a little bit now, but you know, it looks like they've got three or four projects there that could potentially be, you know, historical. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that one moves. I think the market cap's around the £11 million mark, so it'd be interesting to see how it plays out. But certainly look like very, very good grades, and obviously shares are up 60% on the week, so that was a good mover. EUA up 25%. That's a retail punter's favourite. I mean, will anything ever happen, do you think, this stock, in terms of a sale of the assets in Russia? They've had no solid news since last year. The end of the year, maybe rising on the back of any, you know, potential peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. I think you alluded to that a couple of weeks ago.
Just pure
So
speculation.
yeah,
Pure
absolutely.
speculation. I don't know. I mean, don't want to upset everybody, but I think the chances of something positive, i.e., a mine or anything else coming out of that is slim to zero, to be honest. But there you go. Only my opinion.
Yeah, so EPP Energy Pathways up 25%. They announced that they made significant progress on the Mesh Energy Storage Project, aiming to support the UK's Clean Power by 2030 initiative. And the company has signed a non-binding memorandum of understanding with a clean energy fund for cornerstone equity financing, will complement in its existing global green asset financing loan facility. And I believe discussions are also underway with a FTSE 100 company regarding a long-term gas storage capacity and gas sales offtake agreements, as well as potential project debt financing. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, they also announced in the same release that they'd submitted the final concept engineering report for Mesh H2, which is obviously the large scale hydrogen storage facility, to the Department of for Energy Security and Net Zero, or DESNZ. What did you make of that news? And another good announcement, wasn't it, in the week from Energy Pathways?
Yeah, they're just building, aren't they? They're just building a business, really, and it seems to be step by step by step. So they haven't made a false step yet. A bit surprised it didn't go a bit higher, to be honest. I think it probably did and then came back down a bit. Because yeah, still, if they keep making all these steps, this is going to be worth a few hundred million pounds, I think, and possibly significantly more if they extend it beyond, the Marram project to other projects. So yeah, it's one of those, if it works, then you're going to be sitting on something that is very, very valuable, and will be for decades to come, I think. I suppose it's a bit like our guest that we've just had, I think it's something that could last many lifetimes, and yeah, it's one of those things that I think if you are sitting on it now and waiting, I think it could provide energy security for the UK for a few decades. Towards the end of this decade, and yeah, that is going to be very profitable for whoever is taking the chance. Now, that is the chance, but do you see another energy way that the UK is going to secure themselves at the minute?
Not really. I mean, they're so heavily reliant on foreign imports of you know, LNG. Obviously, they're not going to admit it, but I do still believe Russian gas is coming in through the likes of Germany. You know, obviously there's going to be other sources. That there was talk of, you know, as we talked about the opener, about the relationship between Starmer and Trump, that, you know, the potential there for shoring up energy from the US when they, you know, drill baby drill was Trump's motto, and there was talk of maybe Starmer talking to him about maybe shoring up a little bit of energy from them, but I don't think so. I think we've got to become more self, you know, aware and use renewable energy. I mean, you know, the drive hydrogen there. I love the whole hydrogen storage facility. Obviously, the Marram. I mean, you know, when this, as you said originally, when EPP first came to market, it was all about the Marram energy field itself. You know, the actual the gas, the amount of gas that's under it's like BCF, isn't it? Multiple BCF of gas on the Marram field, and that's just one of three licenses as well. So, you know, that obviously they've not switched from that. That's still happening, but they've got now many more strings to the bow of the company. So it's a very exciting company's Energy Pathways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so a good week, bad week. I always like these comparisons. I'm talking about in the automobile space. So Rolls-Royce had a really good week. I don't know if you saw that, but their shares surged by about 15%. They reached a record high of £7.39 per share, and that increase was attributed to the company's announcement that it will achieve its profit targets 2 years ahead of schedule, driven by post-pandemic travel rebound and business simplification under the CEO Tufan Erginbilgic. In 2024, Rolls-Royce reported a 15.8% rise in revenue to £17.85 billion and a 57% increase in underlying operating profit to £2.5 billion. The company has also reinstated the dividends at 6 pence per share payout and announced a £1 billion share buyback, totaling £1.5 billion to be returned to share. I mean, that buyback alone was great news. Obviously, that landed in the week, and then Rolls-Royce also upgraded its midterm targets, projecting operating profits between £3.6 billion and £3.9 billion by 2028. So, fantastic news. Obviously, not just a luxury car manufacturer. You know, you've got the engine part of the business as well, and then on the opposite side of that, Kev, you know, the good week, bad week, Aston Martin, their share price dropped. I think they were down about 30% on Friday. They recently announced, unfortunately, a 5% reduction in the workforce, equating to approximately 170 jobs as part of this cost-cutting strategy to address financial challenges, which included a £289 million loss last year and a £1.16 billion debt. I mean, it couldn't be much, you know, they couldn't be much more of an antithesis to Rolls-Royce if they tried, could they really, Aston Martin?
No, it would seem so. But when you look, I mean, what price were people buying Rolls-Royce during the dark days, if you like? Because I remember, you know, everyone was worried about Rolls-Royce going out of business, and because I mean, it's not really a car manufacturer anymore. Surely it's more jet engines to that contribute than the car side of things. About 4 years ago, Rolls-Royce was in a lot of difficulties. Share price was, you know, on the floor. I think if you'd bought and held at that point, you've probably got a 10, 12 bagger, because I think it probably dropped to around the 60p mark. As anybody who got in under a pound, it's been an absolute gift that keeps on giving. Even as early as sort of 2 years ago, it was only a pound, £1.20, and then started to move up. But we're going to need these engines. We don't need the Rolls-Royces, but obviously it is a consumable that people want. So yeah, so good luck,
Can
but
you imagine? Can you imagine if they managed to get this small modular reactor as well developed and tested and actually put into production? How much that will drive further their you know revenues and profit margins? So, you know, it'd be interesting to see. But you're absolutely right.
They're obviously feeling confident. They've got £1 billion free of cash to go and buy their stock back, and also they're willing to pay sort of a 1% dividend as it stands at the minute, or just less than 1% dividend. So they are obviously positive in terms of what they've got, what they think's coming. They're not going to start a dividend until they've probably got several years of that money ready to go. So yeah, it's looking a very strong business now. How much more equity upside? Don't know. But yeah, if you'd bought at that time, that was one of those FTSE 100 companies that dropped out the FTSE 100 probably and then shot back up or will shoot back up.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So 6 billion marks, it's about 6.3 billion market cap with 2023 revenues of around 7.35 billion from what I can see. The operating profit reached 2.5 billion in 2023. Yeah, but and as you say, they are an aerospace engine, and that's their primary revenue generator. I mean, if, in 2024, they actually sold 5,700 vehicles worldwide, which was the best sales year to date. So they are increasing, and you know, there's been a lot of people in the Far East, in China, who really want to own these, you know, everyone says it's the Rolls Royce. So, you know, as
the
new
prestigious,
money,
isn't it?
it's the most, yeah, absolutely is. And they make amazing cars, you know, they're the most luxury vehicle you can get, you know. So it's great to see that. And as I say, Aston Martin, unfortunately, struggling along. Obviously, they've got the partnership with AMG providing the engines, but it remains to be seen whether or not they can actually turn that. The big losses, a 289 million loss last year with a 1.16 billion pound debt on the books. But
Again, the problem is that they are purely a car manufacturer, isn't it? And the car manufacturing, car production is just all over the place because you've got many decisions to make, whether you go electric, whether you stay with the combustion engine, what type of cars do we see people doing? I mean, who was it? Was it Jaguar that did those adverts before Christmas?
well, the whole car market is in complete disarray because of government. Like, you know, no, nobody knows whether they're making electric, pure EV, whether they should be making hybrid, whether they should be, you know, still manufacturing diesel engines, whether they should be, you know, internal combustion engine should be retired. I mean, I wouldn't want to be a car manufacturer in the current times because there's just so much uncertainty, again, because of regulation. But I mean, let's move swiftly on. Let's have a look at some of the standout RNSs of the week. I mean, Technology Minerals announced that they'd obtained a transfrontier shipment of waste, a TFS license, enabling the transport of black mass to Europe under the agreement with Glencore. The initial 100-ton shipment scheduled for March 2025. Black mass produced at Recyclus's lithium-ion battery recycling facility contains valuable metals like lithium, manganese, nickel, and cobalt, which can be reprocessed and reintroduced into the battery supply chain. This development signifies a major milestone for Recyclus and underscores the quality of its recycling technology. Pretty muted reaction, I thought, to that on the market. I thought that you know, that obviously they've been holding out. There was a lot riding on that TFS being available to them, which obviously enables that transport of the black mass to Europe. What did you make of the news?
Well, it's fantastic news, really, to be honest with you, for the business. I mean, here we are with a tiny micro cap company now, Tech Minerals stroke Recyclist, with a deal with Glencore to basically ship as much black mass as they've got. So, you know, the scenario is that good? No, it's great from a point of view of that company. It's also going to add another income stream. So you've now not just got the gate fees at a cost of actual recycling, but you're going to have the black mass to sell to move on. So I know their greater plans were that they might be able to recycle the black mass themselves, but I think that's a step too far just at this moment in time. If they can get this circular economy going, getting the batteries, taking money from the batteries, taking the, you know, recycling the batteries, and then recycling that black mass into Europe for now, and make that whole thing economically viable, which I think they're on the cusp of doing. They really, in my view, they're on the cusp of it. They need another deal. If they get one more, maybe two more deals, then they're going to be coming to the point where they are cash flow neutral or cash flow positive in Recyclist, which will then leave TM1 shareholders in a much, much better position, as TM1 is owed a lot of money from Recyclist. It will allow, I believe, Recyclist to raise money once they're in a situation where they are cash flow neutral at least, and open a lot more doors for them. So yeah, I'm actually looking forward and very positive, but they've obviously got a debt burden, both with Atlas and some CLNs that are outstanding. So all of those things have got to be looked at. From a negative point of view, the critical metals share prices tanked. So that obviously hasn't helped. But maybe that's short term, maybe that's long term, who knows? But there is still going to be money to allow them to move forward with some of that stuff. So there's many positives. So for it to stick where it is in terms of the share price, I think it just needs some encouragement with hopefully another deal. and then we'll see where we go.
Good. Okay, Bazant Resources, obviously there was an announcement that they said they'd agreed to sell the subsidiary Puna Metals SA, which holds the Eureka project in Argentina, to Ajax Resources. The deal includes an initial payment of $120,000 in cash and a deferred consideration of $100,000 in Ajax shares, payable upon Ajax's successful listing on a recognized stock exchange. The Eureka project is in an advanced exploration stage with potential to become a low-cost gold and copper mine within 3 to 4 years, subject to permitting and other factors. But yeah, what did you make of that Bazant news? I mean, interesting one, that you know, disposal of the you know, that asset really,
Yeah,
isn't it?
I just see Colin disposing of the stuff that isn't relevant, you know, because he's not going to go off to South America and do it, is he? So the fact that he got something for it was, you know, tremendous, couple of $100,000, which is maybe 5-6% of the market cap of Bazant for something that was just sitting there. Basically, he wasn't going to forward it, take it up, or advance it, I should say. So yeah, I think it's good. It's clearing the decks for Hope and Garup, and Hope and Garup to become a producer, and then they continue to explore in Hope and Garup. I mean, again, it's my great white hope, if you like. I really do think Hope and Garup is going to be one of those ones you look back on and wish you'd invested in Bazant. The only negative about Bazant this week, and it's both a positive and a negative, was the finances that
Oh, the
they
Sanderson.
agreed with Sanderson, that they brought the price down from 0.06 to 0.025 because they extended it for another year without having to pay it.
So that means
So
effectively more dilution going forward.
it's double the dilution on that money, which is not good. But I don't think they had a choice, did they? Because they don't have the cash as we speak. So yeah. And also bring Sanderson into the party in a better way, if you like, you know, so they are in to win it, if you like. So let's hope that's a positive.
Yeah, and the other RNS this week was moving closer to home, was obviously Ireland. Was Conroy Gold announced they identified new gold and antimony trends at the Clontibret deposit through remodeling and PXRF analysis, highlighting potential for high-grade gold at depth. A second antimony trend has been discovered, paralleling the stockwork gold mineralization, with scout drilling revealing further antimony potential in previously unexplored areas. So looks like things are moving forward there. You know, obviously antimony there, second antimony trend. And what do you know to that? Obviously, this is supporting ongoing discussions with the potential strategic and financial partners, as we talked about, as they head out to PDAC, which is on next week, and obviously looking for the next investment phase in the Discs of Gold project.
Yeah, well, you remember when we were down in that little river, down the little stream, and they showed us the entrance to the antimony mines. And as Kevin said, they didn't mine a great deal of antimony because, you know, they weren't there that long, and it was pretty simple techniques, if you like. But they seem, from the information I read in the RNS, that, you know, that we've got dips of gold going down, and obviously the antimony as well. And a lot of the language they used was exactly what they use in the Fosterville language as well, in terms of this, you know, greater grades of gold that dips down. And if it is to be the length that we're talking about, which is basically Clontibret and Clay Lake are probably connected in some way, you're talking about 8 to 10 kilometers of strike, stockwork, whatever you want to call it. Which would just be a humongous project, it really would, and that's without anything else that Conroy have got. So I really do hope they go to PDAC and get somebody who's willing to put their hands in their pockets and go for it. And Carillion, well, they had news there on Friday, didn't they? More news about the green diamonds and the fact that it looks like they have the source, but they need somebody to help them drill it now, I think. And it's the same thing, really. If they get somebody, then, you know, there's no way it's worth £1.5 million or whatever it is, or less than that, I think, £1.2 million. And Conroy is worth maybe 1.5 million or something like that. It's crazy. You know, these
Oh, you're
could be
right.
10 baggers just on those news, on the news that they have deals to move forward, because they are so lowly valued. So
Yeah,
yeah, watch this space. Let's see what happens. I mean, I'm having been there a few times. Yes, I just see that the potential is there, and it's going to take a while, that is for sure. And it's already taken a flipping ridiculous length of time. But now it seems, with the goals of this project, everything is in place. And the same with the just waiting for that license now in Finland, the Lähiöoikeus, they could be the catalysts for somebody to come in and say, yeah, here's the money,
Yeah,
let's
they
start
need to pull
drilling.
it out of the bag now, that's for sure. I mean, last week we talked about the Freddo wage index with Charles, or he came up with this, which I found really so it's very interesting and also quite humorous as well. And we'd obviously talked about previously about this shrinkflation, where things just seem to get smaller, but obviously at the same time also more costly. A great example would be a Freddo, or would be, a Snickers bar. As you say, it's almost,
Fruit pastels.
yeah, one bite and it's gone. It's like it is literally get it in one bite. But I found this one interesting, and cars are obviously quite an expensive purchase, so drivers often consider what amount is reasonable to spend on a vehicle. Now, salaries across Europe obviously vary. The company called Car Vertical conducted a study to determine how many months buyers need to work in different countries to purchase a used car. In the UK, the average salary is £2,524 a month, and drivers typically spend around £16,400 for a used car. Therefore, people in the UK would need to work an average of 6.5 months to buy a second-hand vehicle. I mean, obviously, in reality, it's going to take up to a few times longer, considering that a person may is not going to be able to save 100% of their income each month. So it was interesting. They pulled the countries together, and they found that where drivers need to work longest or the most to get a used car were Portugal at 22.4 months, so nearly 2 years. Romania was 15.4 months, and Serbia was 14.7 months. And then countries where drivers need to work the least to get a used car was Finland at 2.7 months, Germany at 6 months, and Switzerland at 6.1. And at nearly €39,000, the highest average used car value in Switzerland, followed by Austria 28,000 and Portugal 24. The least amount spent on a car is in the Ukraine, which is €5,000, and Latvia 7 and Finland 8. So
The one in Ukraine doesn't
yeah,
have an engine.
it's just a blown out vehicle, a shell of a vehicle probably. But yeah, no, it's just interesting how the different countries, not only, I mean, Switzerland's interesting because they're obviously the higher earners. They're probably one of the highest earners in terms of average salary, but they're still 6.1 months. So yeah, very, very interesting that one.
So
And
does
then
that say
obviously,
more about salaries or more about cars? I'm not sure which.
yeah, maybe Tesla backlash. Obviously, Tesla is experiencing a decline in sales, particularly in Europe, attributing to CEO Elon Musk's political involvement and controversial public gestures. The backlash reflects the complex relationship between corporate leadership actions and consumer sentiment. Gene Hackman, obviously renowned actor, was, and his wife were found deceased under circumstances authorities are now describing as potentially suspicious. Entertainment industry and fans worldwide mourn the loss of the iconic actor. And then
That's
on
very
the last
sad.
one,
They went
yeah,
together,
T
didn't they, by the looks of
they
things?
did, yeah. TV recommendations. I mean, I saw one on Netflix, which was really political, which was fantastic with the great Robert De Niro. Zero Day, six episode political thriller on Netflix. Former U.S. president, after a catastrophic cyber attack causes nationwide chaos and numerous fatalities, Mullen is called out of retirement by the current president, Evelyn Mitchell, portrayed by Angela Bassett, to lead the Zero Day Commission. It is fascinating. It's all about conspiracies, lies. It's a bit sort of like, did you ever watch the West Wing? West Wing? Did you ever see that?
No, not really.
No.
But
Great.
was one of the ones you talked about a few weeks back called Landman?
No,
It
not
was.
seen
I
that
think
one.
it's on. I think it's on Amazon Prime. I think it is. It's called Landman or TOD, which is
Okay.
one of the networks I get here. It was very good. It was very good. It's all about oil in West Texas and
Okay.
the land. And I like the actor as well. And it was a good series. I just started watching a couple of days ago the Reacher.
Reacher, yeah.
Jack Reacher. I liked him.
Yeah.
I saw the first series a long time ago, and now there's been two more, so I started to watch those again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good ones there. I mean, that Zero Day is interesting because De Niro plays the ex or the retired president of the US, but there's no political persuasion in it in terms of it doesn't identify whether he's Republican or Democrat. And a lot of the US fans or US, the viewers are in uproar saying, well, how can we kind of like two sides on whether he's a good, and I'm like, that's not the point. This is he's an actor, you know. It doesn't matter whether he's Republican or Democrat, you know. It's like the West Wing identified, and I think it was a Democrat in that, if I remember rightly. So there was people who were maybe fans who were Democrat, and they didn't, you know. And there was obviously a lot of arguments with the Republicans, but this doesn't. It's not about that. It's about the fact that it's about the effect, the impact on society and conspiracy theories and how people will backstab other people. It's a very, very compelling watch. But as I say, the only people that are slating it are the people in the US who kind of just want to identify to a political persuasion. So very interesting times. But I think we've talked long enough. Yeah. Anything else you want to add, Kev, there before we wrap up?
No, I don't think so. Let's see how the markets are moving. We're definitely continuing to get a few winners. So, it's I think the markets are looking more positive. So let's hope the cash seems to come at this end of the market anyway. There seems to be there's going to be a few wobbles at the US market and the top of the market because as far as I can see, it's way overvalued in terms of what it is. So let's hope we get some rotation of that cash. Coming down to the real things, as Sapan was talking about as well.
Absolutely. Well,
Commodities.
thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe and hit the bell icon for any further notifications. And yeah, thanks for listening and have a great weekend all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.